Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents Revolution, featuring your host, Heisey Lutmers.
Thank you for joining me today, and I'm also joined this morning for our roundtable discussion by our co-hosts from some of our other shows, Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Good morning.
John Carosella.
Good morning.
And Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
And today I'm going to put forth a topic for conversation that I came across reading a blog post from someone that had led, well, it's called a circle, but they had led kind of a workshop retreat kind of thing around this topic. And it was on the idea of living a remarkable life in a conventional world. So I would like to put out to the other people here on the panel, when you hear that term, a remarkable life and living a remarkable life, what does that mean to you? What would you say is or constitutes a remarkable life?
You know, when there was something in the material that you sent over that included the statement that your work in life doesn't have to be big, it just has to be fitting. And to me, a remarkable life, if I think of, like, if I'm going to point to somebody and say, wow, he lived a remarkable life or she lived a remarkable life, I think it would really be that they did something that they did so elegantly, so from their heart center, right? So aligned with who they are. And you know, one that comes to mind is my Uncle Nick, who is an Italian immigrant. He was a caretaker on an estate for his whole life. And he basically was a gardener for his whole life. And that wasn't big work, but it was so beautiful to see, to bear witness to him being who he was for his whole life. And that's not to say that he was flawless, but he was a gardener. And that was remarkable to me because it just suited him so well. And he committed himself to being that. And I think that's remarkable.
I think one thing that brings up for me, though, in the way that you just said that, is we often fall into the trap of hearing a question like, what is a remarkable life? What does it mean to live a remarkable life? And we immediately put it in the context of someone else, that we look for someone else who represents living a remarkable life rather than being able to see ourselves living a remarkable life and how we might be doing that and how we can do that. So I would also challenge you to consider how you might be living a remarkable life or how you can live a remarkable life and what that would mean. And I was wondering if Mildred or Deb, if you have any thoughts when you hear that term, that phrase, living a remarkable life in a conventional world, what that means to you.
For me, it was, it took me a moment, and my initial reaction was, I'm so busy just trying to live the life that I'm trying to live that I haven't got a clue whether to even think about it being remarkable or ordinary or disappointing or any of those things. The question arose in me a sense of, what is remarkable? And it's leads me, you to think, or me to think, that it's something extraordinary, something beyond. And most often I'm not in a place where I'm considering that I'm doing anything extraordinary or beyond. As I said, I'm simply trying to muddle through with what I got. And so the idea of doing something remarkable is kind of at the extreme edges of my consciousness.
So what if we redefined that word for you and said that living a remarkable life could include simply living our own life in the fullest and best way possible, of being present in our own life in every moment and doing whatever it is we do in our life to the fullest and the best, and just owning every moment of our lives as remarkable, rather than it having to be some grand thing that might be recognized by others.
That certainly changes the perspective, and it does make it easier to understand and to bring into my personal consciousness, that, you know, looking at it from that definition instead of the literal word remarkable and all of the connotation that goes along with that. You know, hopefully in my attempts to do what I do and get through each day, there's a little bit of that going on. Even in the mundane, there are joyful aspects of the mundane. And I like that that exists, and that I note them and I'm aware of them and I'm grateful for them. And so perhaps right now, that's the best I can do. And that is where I am doing it.
You know, I see, just as an opportunity for reflection, I see you living the remarkable life, quote unquote remarkable life, when you do art, you do artistic things. That felt like an expression of remarkableness.
What I said just a little while ago is finding joy in the mundane. I don't think of those moments as particularly remarkable. I think of them as moments of relaxation and joy. And so, in a sense, they're simply a part of who I am and my expression in the world. And that lends a little bit of mundane ordinariness to them.
So that fits the bill, right? Because for you, it's just you being you and having fun.
Right.
And for me, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
Which is... So, I mean, maybe remarkableness is in the eye of the beholder.
Perhaps.
And it does come back to the quote that John was referencing, which is a quote from Christina Baldwin in her book, The Seven Whispers. And it basically says, our work need not be grand, only fitting. So, again, it takes away that sense that it has to be some big thing versus are we simply doing what is fitting and authentic and right in that moment for that thing, whether it's creating a piece of art or saving children from HIV in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but regardless of how big or small, are we doing what's fitting, and are we stepping up to simply be ourselves and do what it is that we have to offer to its fullest in that moment and for that thing? So, Mildred, might we hear the lovely dulcet tones of your Nova Scotia voice?
You mean my authentic, natural lilt?
Exactly. Your remarkable lilt.
Oh, I have to agree 100%. Anyway, I love this topic, and when I read the sentence, how to live a remarkable life in a conventional world, I went to the dictionary. And just to make sure I was on course, so remarkable is worthy of attention, and conventional is based on or in accordance with what's generally done or believed. And I sat there and I went inside and I decided that, yes, indeed, I do lead a remarkable life in a conventional world. And before you're sitting there all gasping, thinking she thinks she's great, and maybe not, maybe you know I'm great, but...
I was not the least bit surprised, Mildred.
So I went in a little deeper, and what I found it is when you're listening to your inner voice and your inner voice, and you have the courage to act on your inner voice, then life becomes remarkable in all aspects, because you start to notice things and you start to become more present. And I've noticed that the remarkable part is that you have an increased sense of wonder and joy and well-being and meaningfulness and happiness, just about everything. And it fills you up. So the external part, or the conventional part, becomes more and more non-relevant to your life. So that's where I went with it. And then I thought to myself, well, if you wanted to become more present and aware and more conscious, well, what would be a first step? And then what I thought of, and this would work for me, is to start to cultivate a world that is non-conventional. And you could do it easily through either books or movies or people or groups. So that's where I went with that one.
Well, there was a couple of other questions that were in this blog that came from the workshops that they were doing. And I'm just going to put them out there for people to consider. And then I'm going to come to a third question that I'd like all of the co-hosts to also perhaps toss out there as a suggestion. So a couple of other things to consider around this topic are, how might you live out the values of community, service, and adventure? Because I think a lot of times those aspects are very much what people think of if they think of a remarkable life, that somehow they have touched or changed a community, or somebody has been very adventurous in their life, or they've been of service and really been able to affect people in some way, even if it's just one person. Another question, what project might excite you and fill you with joy? And I think if people would start to think about that and then put that into action in the immediate moment or in the very near future, they would start, like Mildred was saying, they would start to move towards creating a more remarkable existence for themselves, because they would be doing something that brings them joy and probably excites them and lets them get up in the morning and makes them look forward to the day rather than dreading another day. And then what I would like for the co-hosts to consider tossing out as a little tip for people and for anyone listening to think about for themselves is to start putting this in action. What is an action item that you could do in the next 24 hours to move closer to living a remarkable life, to creating that kind of life that excites you, that brings you joy? What's one thing that can be done within 24 hours to start down that path or to start creating that?
I have an idea.
Okay.
Okay, as always, my ideas are couched around a nice cup of tea. So what I would do, and what I'm going to do, is I would suggest for the listeners if they could explore what type of conversations fill their days and if they're meaningful. And if they're finding that the conversations that fill their days are not relevant or meaningful, ask yourself why not, and look at what type of conversations you'd like to be having for a more fulfilling existence. And the conversation you could start with first would be with yourself.
Yeah, something that came to me was, you know, an example, ways that you be in service or community or whatever, that as examples of living a remarkable life. And what came to me in that was being an awesome parent to your children, or being an awesome spouse to your partner. You know, if you can invest yourself in being those things, I think those are really powerful ways of powerful and intimate ways of experiencing conscious remarkableness.
I think sort of staying along this vein of community and communication, something that I know I personally have not been particularly strong at is reaching out to those individuals that are within my circle of friends or acquaintances. I have characteristically been a pretty laid back individual, and most often communication comes from the outside in to me. So something that I'm finding to be very relevant and
useful in my life right this moment is my taking the action of reaching out to the other first. And even if it's simply a, hi, I haven't talked to you in a little while. I'm thinking of you. Just wanted to say hello kind of thing. For me, because as I said, it hasn't been a part of my standard operating procedure. That's something that I could do within the next 24 hours, very doable. And, it has meaning. It has meaning for, me on a very heart level. Because my friends and associates are very dear to me, and I realize what they mean. And so my reaching out to them and not waiting for them to come to me, I think is a very first step for me to be find joy in the mundane.
Joy in the mundane. Hang out with your friends.
And I think that speaks to something that anyone could do in the next 24 hours is, instead of just saying you're going to do something or thinking about doing something, take action on actually doing it. Instead of saying, oh, I need to send so-and-so an email, stop, sit at your computer, pick up your phone, pick up your iPad, and send an email. It'll take you a couple of minutes. Or pick up the phone and call, or whatever it is. But instead of just talking about it and then moving on to something else, take a moment to stop and do that thing, and you'll find it won't be nearly the interruption of the day that you fear that it might, because you think, I just don't have time to do that right now, versus it'll take you 2 minutes and it'll be done. There may be something more elaborate that you need to say or follow up on later, and you may not be able to send everything in that one email or whatever, but at least you can send the initial thing. So you've taken the first step. You've set it in motion rather than always being something that's going to happen at some point in the future.
And hi, C, if you type in how to be a remarkable person, because I did this before our session together, there's a few websites and blog sites that have lists of things that you can do.
Well,
to cultivate that action.
That's a doable action people can do in the next 24 hours is sit down and Google how to be a remarkable person.
Exactly.
And then look
and
see
one
what
and
some of
it.
Those suggestions are, and then say, I'm going to do that one thing in the next 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, what did we do before Google?
Talk to our friends.
All right. Well, hopefully that inspires people listening to think about what they can do within the next 24 hours to start taking a step towards living a more remarkable life for themselves in a conventional world, rather than simply giving into convention and conforming to how the world says they should be living. So thank you very much to my co-hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald. John,
great topic, Heisey. Thank you.
John Carosella.
Yes, thanks, Heisey. It was great.
And Deb Carosella.
My pleasure.
And stay tuned, because coming up we have our regular segments, our astrology update, and our Living Well segment with Linda. If you'd like to get a reading a little later in the show, feel free to get in the queue, Skype in from the show page, or call 646-716-5510. And my special revolutionary guest this month is Normandy Ellis, who is an author, speaker, traveler, poet, and she is going to be talking to us about how to connect and contact the spirit world in the style of the ancient Egyptians. So you won't want to miss that. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
You can dance in the devil's shoes.
As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance? With Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. Introducing our newest show, the second and fourth Saturday mornings each month, From Beyond, with mother-daughter psychics Nadia Shapiro and Barbara Williams. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
I'm Tino Calenda, your queer astrologer, and here is another transmission from the stars. This will be your astro report covering October 7th to November 15th. Starting October 7th, Venus entered into Sagittarius. And Venus, of course, deals with our ability to connect with other people. It deals with the desire nature. It deals with how we love. Having it in a sign like Sagittarius definitely means that a few interesting themes are going to come up. It's a fire sign. It's a very enthusiastic sign. It's all about being big and expansive. Deals with foreign lands, foreign cultures, foreigners themselves. So, you know, maybe you might get some action with someone from another country. It's also about exploring the unknown frontier. So Sagittarius likes to sit there and aim those arrows nice and high and then shoot off to the sky and then follow those arrows wherever they might lead. So I would say having Venus in Sagittarius also in a pretty good trine aspect to Uranus, who's in Aries, that sets the stage for the possibility of love coming from foreign lands or love coming from a foreigner. It will also involve issues around governance because Sagittarius does have some roles in law and government and administration. So we might expect to see sort of an increase heightened awareness around the social connections that people have with one another. We could definitely see some important foreign diplomacy issues come to the fore media-wise. So we definitely need to be prepared to deal with the possibility of things foreign to us on a much more intimate level than usual. So that's sort of how like a practical thing that we can keep in mind is that Venus will make us question what our relationship to the unknown is. Starting October 15th, we have Mars entering Virgo. Mars actually is very happy in the sign of Virgo, largely because if Virgo represents practical application to the world, Mars represents the impulse to act and the energy behind getting things done. So Mars actually now has this very viable channel to channel its energy into doing practical work in the world. So it's really an important time to figure out practically what actions you're taking that have a very practical nature to them. So are your actions necessarily fruitful? Are they producing anything of practical value for you or in your life? Or are you just spinning your wheels? October 18th, we have a full moon in Aries at 25 degrees. It is sitting in opposition to the sun at Libra, which is at 25 degrees Libra. So eclipses represent exposure, disorientation, excitement and crisis, radical departures, transformations, and a need to act and strong evolutionary change. So they expose deeply hidden materials. The themes that are going to come up is it's going to challenge our ability to relate to others. It's temporarily put on hold and out of balance. Our minds will be a little more focused on personal concerns, including any identity crises. Those will take precedence, potentially warping objectivity and straining relations. The eclipse affords a chance to see ourselves reflected through our relationships. We may experience people assisting us in our personal objectives or possibly others initiating us to make efforts in relating to their desires and emotions. It's definitely time to advocate for yourself and reach clarity around relationships as well, as an excellent time to let go of past conditioning around all of your relations. Avoid betraying true feelings in a bid to keep the peace. This will not prove ultimately successful. So we have to be true to ourselves and recognize that while we need to be tactful, we do need to say it like it is, even if it might hurt our relationships to some extent. October 21st, Mercury moves into retrograde at 18 degrees Scorpio. This is definitely a Hermes that gives meaning to the namesake Hermes, because it's essentially when Mercury likes to become a hermit. So, in essence, from our vantage point here on Earth, Mercury will be appearing to move backwards in his orbit. Definitely an important time and a chance to regroup, examine our thinking around issues of sex, death, shadow, survival, and our connection to others. Scorpio deals with the depths and deals with the intimate connections that we have with other people. We can definitely expect to see breakdowns occurring in terms of government situations. A really good example of this would be many of the technical glitches that we're experiencing with the Affordable Care Act going online. Expect to see more of that during a retrograde period, and you definitely want to prepare for it. As with all Mercury retrograde, it's a great time to make sure that you have your tires changed on your car in case you run a flat, to make sure there's extra gas in the gas tank, to make sure that if your computer needs any kind of servicing, take it in now, take it in prior to the retrograde, most definitely. These tend to last quite a long time. October 28th, we have an exact sextile between Pluto and Chiron, with Pluto hanging out at 9 degrees Capricorn, Chiron hanging out at 9 degrees Pisces. So Chiron and Pisces, they're also both going into retrograde motion. So this transit will be deeply internal. We're going to see less in terms of the objective world and a lot more in terms of the subjective world. So it's really more of a call to go within. So Chiron in Pisces is going to be dealing with deep collective wounds. And so we're talking about healing deep wounds that are present in humanity. With Pluto in Capricorn as part of that sextile, putting the healer and the transformer in very, very harmonious relationship to one another. In essence, the two are making love to one another. It will definitely allude to themes behind the government shutdown that we're seeing. We're seeing that we have this extreme group of people that is betraying the collective sense of security because they want to have their very personal demands met. And essentially what this is going to mean is that the deep underlying structures behind these kinds of institutions are going to be deeply questioned, and hopefully that bringing that sort of rot and decay to the surface will heal them, will actually initiate a healing process. And that's sort of the idea. But again, Chiron also represents the wounded healer. So it's the wound that we're always going to have. It's chronic. But we always have an opportunity to heal from its flare-ups. We never can get rid of the condition so much as eventually we just learn to live with it and learn to understand the healing process behind it, that these wounds are going to continue to come up, but we just have to be aware about healing them. So in essence, we're seeing the first part of a much longer transit of Pluto through Capricorn, which is essentially asking us to transform every one of our institutions, from religion to government to anything that essentially has to do with what holds us together as a society. So to have this sort of on-ramp means we'll start addressing some of the fundamental wounds that are part of our institutional framework. So we're going to start seeing potentially quite a bit more in regards to how this government shutdown is impacting people, and sort of the damage control that we're going to have to initiate as part of that. Essentially, the shutdown is going to have reverberations that are going to continue well beyond its arc, especially if we default on our loans. But again, it's also an opportunity to recognize that and to start putting into place the stuff for healings. For a little more of a practical thing, I would say that people really need to figure out where they stand on the issue and then essentially do whatever they can on the activist side, if that means writing a letter to your congressperson, if that means drunk dialing your congressperson, which there is actually now a website where you can do that. Do it, because essentially that's what this whole thing is going to push. It's going to push us to collectively understand our fractured relationship to each other on a massive scale and to transform that relationship in some way, which of course leads us to November 1st, when we experience the first exact square of Pluto to Uranus. Uranus is at 9 degrees Aries, Pluto will be at 9 degrees Capricorn. And again, what are we seeing? If Uranus in Aries represents creativity and motion and represents the power of the individual, and Pluto in Capricorn represents government and social institutions, the square relationship represents a necessity for the individual to confront institutional frameworks and demand their transformation in very surprising and unexpected ways. So the energy is similar to the Uranus-Pluto conjunction we saw in the 60s. So if that conjunction saw the 60s and saw massive social transformation and rebellion, what we're seeing here is the other shoe dropping. So the individual will essentially, in the onslaught and the assault of collective institutions that do not have the individual in mind, such as corporations and government, we're going to see that the individual is going to demand and require that institutional frameworks confront their corruption. The last time we saw this square emerge was in 2011, and that was about the time we saw the Occupy movement and we saw the Arab Spring. So it's big, it's definite. And again, for more practical advice for dealing with this, recognize that your own individual experience of institutions at this time will be colored by that. You might find some frustration with dealing with, let's say, the DMV, or dealing with a government agency, or dealing with the IRS. Tax season is coming up relatively soon, kids. So essentially, practical advice is avoid anything impulsive because we're dealing with some fiery elements here. And make sure that you have a federal case if you're going to confront any institutions during this transit. This is Tino Calenda with your monthly Astro Report, committed to delivering round, firm astrology. Be sure to read my blog at flyingpunkrockunicorn.wordpress.com. That's flyingpunkrockunicorn.wordpress.com, and email me at calenda.tino@gmail.com. That's calenda.tino@gmail.com for your queer astrology questions.
And as you might have heard, we have a guest astrologer filling in for James Moran. James is actually off to India, where he's going to be getting married, so he's taking a little bit of a hiatus. And filling in for James is Tino Calenda, who is a great astrologer. So hopefully you enjoyed what he had to offer for the upcoming month, and we may be hearing from him for the next couple of months as James enjoys the process of getting married and settling into his new life. So we want to thank Tino for having filled in, and we want to wish all the best to James over in India. I'm very excited for my guest coming up, Normandy Ellis, and I think you're going to find her quite fascinating to hear. She's also been very gracious to offer to join me in doing readings for people. So if you would like to get a reading a little later in the show, feel free to Skype in from the show page, or you can call 646-716-5510 to get into the queue. And I always encourage people to get into the queue early, because sometimes We can't get through all of the people that call in, so the earlier you get in, the more likely you are to get a reading. And it's an extra special treat today because you will also be getting a reading from Normandy. So sit back and relax and enjoy my conversation with this month's revolutionary guest, Normandy Ellis. Revolutionary guest this month is Normandy Ellis, an author, speaker, traveler, translator, and workshop leader. Normandy Ellis is perhaps most well known for her translation of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, Awakening Osiris. Among her other works are Feasts of Light, a book of essays on Egypt titled Dreams of Isis, her book of poetry titled Voice Forms, as well as her fictional novel, Sorrowful Mysteries and Other Stories. She is a past winner of the Bumbershoot Award for Literature and grants from the Kentucky Foundation for Women. Normandy's newest books on Egypt are Imagining the World into Existence, which Jean Houston has called a masterpiece work, and Invoking the Scribes, which combines her interest in Egypt and journal writing. She just received news that her poetry chapbook, Words on Water, poems written and inspired by the Hieragamos of Hathor and Horus, will be published by Finishing Line Press next year. Normandy Ellis runs Penthouse Retreat Center in Kentucky in the winter and fall, and in the spring and summer, she can be found teaching metaphysics classes at the spiritualist-affiliated Camp Chesterfield in Indiana. Aside from writing, she is a trance medium, and will again be leading a trip to Egypt in November of 2014 with Nikki Scully through Shamanic Journeys. For more information, visit her website at www.normandyellis.com. That's NormandyEllis.com.
So join us as we travel down the Nile on a voyage into the mysteries of ancient Egypt and the Shadow Realm.
As we enter into the dark time of the year, Normandy will guide us through ancient Egyptian concepts of the dead and the afterlife, including two ways of accessing the spirit world via the dualities of the Akhet and the Duat. Please join me in welcoming to the show today, revolutionary guest, Normandy Ellis. And welcome to the show, Normandy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for the wonderful introduction. And thank you for the quotes from Awakening Osiris. That was really fun to listen to.
Well, I was inspired. You had posted that quote when I put the event on Facebook. So I thought, oh, well, I'll just take that and use that for her introduction. So I'm glad you enjoyed that.
I did. Thank you so much.
I know, and I know many people know, that you have a very deep connection and relationship with Egypt. And I noticed that, well, I think that we often in the modern world are giving a sort of a death cult kind of view on the ancient Egyptians. And yet, as we're going into this darker time of year that's a little more oriented towards looking inward, and we also have the idea of death and rebirth with winter and that kind of thing, the rebirth of the sun and the light is what we look forward to as we move through this towards spring. I feel that that's more what the Egyptians tended to be about, was life and rebirth, and not so much this undue fascination with death itself. So could you maybe speak to that a little bit? Have you found that maybe our perspective of them and their obsession with death is a little bit overblown?
Yes, I do think it's a little bit overblown. And I think one of the problems is that when the modern world, we'll call ourselves modern, you know, just because that's a phrase that people will recognize. When we rediscovered Egypt again, we became totally fascinated with opening up the tombs and, trying to, like, pull the mummies out and see if they had any gold or jewel and, you know, what exactly they were trying to do. And it's kind of like, you know, to me, I go back and I think about it now, it's like kind of like baking cookies and taking them out of the oven, you know, while they're baking. You're not going to get a whole lot, and you're not going to find what you're looking for. You know, the goods are if you let it stay in the dark and do its process in the dark. And then when they come out in their own good time, then the sweetness is there. You know, so that's just a baking cookies metaphor but it really has something to do with that because, Osiris, who we think of as the Lord of the Dead, was a god of wheat. And what do we make, you know, our muffins out of, our pumpkin muffins and our cookies and our breads? We make them out of wheat. We crush it. We grind it into, you know, something that it doesn't even resemble as it's growing. And we mix it with things and we pat it down and throw it in the dark. And then when it comes out, you know, it's this wonderful, lush, nurturing, revitalizing feast for us. The source, really, of what the Christian tradition came to know was communion, was that whole Osirian mystery of turning life from death into life again. And that's really what it's about. And, you know, your guests were talking about the communal aspect of things that we can do. And I would say envision and see, as you're baking things for your community, the God spark that's being put into that particular tasty treat, and then when it comes out, sharing it with individuals, true communion of spirit, you know, in my opinion.
And I think that some of that approach or perspective that the Egyptians had that we might not often think about is seen in the way that you have translated the title for what is commonly known as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And you say that it can be translated either as the book of coming forth by day or the book of coming into the light. I think you can also sometimes see it as the secret of Osiris becoming Ra,
which Osiris, as you indicated, was the god of the underworld, Ra being the sun. So again, there's that idea of day or light. So can you maybe speak a little bit to the difference in how you've translated that for those titles and what that offers us in terms of how to view that, and then how those may be used both by the Egyptians in ancient times as well as today, how we can approach and use that not so much as just what happens when you die versus how it's a process or a guidebook for us to be able to use towards that rebirth aspect, whether literal or figurative.
Well, I think that's it. You hit the nail on the head. I think that we have misunderstood that book for so many years, because the scribes who copied it over, you know, and who spent whole lifetimes copying this book, didn't do it just so that you could have like a magic spell to take with you into the underworld. Yes, we'll have to define what magic means in a minute. But the whole power of copying that book and having a copy of that book yourself was to be able to read it and interpret it and incorporate it into, you know, your life, so that a book of the dead was actually a book of the living. You know, it's not going to do you any good after spirit's already made its transition. It only does you any good if you live out the secrets and the mysteries and the true transformative vision that a work like that offers to you. And, you know, it spans like 3,000 years of history, from the Old Kingdom all the way up to Greeks and Romans who were still copying it. And it goes through various types of changes, you know, as any book of prayer tends to do, as we become more understanding about our task, you know, in this life. One of the things that's interesting to me is that, and I always go back to thinking about the Pyramid of Unas, because that particular text for me is the first time that we have any type of spiritual understanding of the next life written down where it could be accessed by other people. Now, granted, they may have done much of that before then on papyrus scrolls and so on, but we don't have any of those anymore. What we have is this apparently full-blown text that later became the Book of the Dead, which is the pyramid text of Unas. And it offers us really a look at how the religion was changing from the Old Kingdom preoccupation with the phoenix and the Bennu bird and you know, the rising from the ashes and the whole ascension consciousness that goes with that, to a little more of the day-to-day raw-oriented transformation that, you know, as the sun moves from east to west and we have our kind of daily transformation, we can also see our lives, you know, we're born, we have a middle age, we die, you know, we perhaps come into a place where we can choose again to be born, you know, and go through the whole process. But there's also an opportunity where you're looking, like, that's kind of the east-west access of the Pyramid of Unas, but there's a cross there, a channel that goes north to south that accesses what was known as the imperishable stars, the stars that are centered around the North Pole and which never rise or set, you know, unlike the sun and the constellations, which are in the equator. These, you know, were considered permanent. And it was there that the gods and the goddess lived, and it was there that the ancestors who were ascended masters lived, and they held the idea, the sparkling, scintillating idea of all that was possible, humanly possible on Earth. And so for us, it was possible to make an ascension up the ladder into a kind of consciousness where we could download the plan of our ancestors and of the masters and bring it back to Earth. And it was that alignment with those stars that allowed for a culture like Egypt to last 3,000 years, because it gave an overarching vision of what was possible. Does that make sense? Kind of in a nutshell how pyramid text strikes me.
Yeah. Well, no, that makes sense. But I think even the pyramid itself, like the Great Pyramid, a lot of people think of that as a tomb, where I think that it's also been shown, and especially coming from the perspective you're offering, that really the pyramid is more of a vehicle for transcendence into the afterlife. And you've been to Egypt many times, and I'm curious what your experience has been being in the Great Pyramid, thinking of it in terms of that vehicle for transcendence versus simply looking at it as an artifact, as a tomb.
Well, I think that the way that it's constructed, and the fact that when you're inside this stone structure, when you're in the heart of it, you're surrounded by granite, which is a crystalline structure. You know, it's volcanic rock, and a crystalline structure, as we know, you know, holds vibration very well. And so it's like a sounding chamber or a resonance chamber that kind of, as you're working with the energy of sound, kind of allows you to enter into trance states while you're there. Those who have gone into the Great Pyramid and do meditations with sound, I mean, you can see that you can physically feel when you're sitting with your back against a wall. You can feel the vibrations of the stone against your body. And when you're inside the sarcophagus lying down and you hear that toning, you can feel the resonance washing from head to toe over you as you lie there. You know, you really get the sound vibrations. And when, in my experience, when you say the name of the high god and bring that energy down from above into the sarcophagus, it really, you know, I've had people say that they see light, you know, coming out of the sarcophagus, that they actually, you know, move out of their bodies until they're brought back down. It's a very powerful place, and there's a resonating chamber above it that has, I think it has 7 layers, kind of like a chakra system in a way. It's called the Davidson Chamber, and some people say it's used to, you know, alleviate the pressure inside the pyramid so that it doesn't crack, but actually it contributes to the resonance inside that particular room. And so I think, again, it's light vibration, sound vibration is the keynote in there. And when you're inside the Great Pyramid, if you tone an E, you know, it can be heard all the way out onto the plateau. You know, it's the one sound that particular Great Pyramid, you know, resonates to.
Wow. And I know that there has been theories put forth that even things like what we call the Book of the Dead or the Book of Coming Forth by Day was used by the Pharaoh, if not other people, as kind of a manual for their own initiatory, some might even call it a shamanic kind of process during their life, to then prepare them for the same kind of transformation during death. I think that your most recent book, Imagining the World into Existence, the subtitle is very interesting to me, An Ancient Egyptian Manual of Consciousness. And I think that perhaps you can speak to this, surely. I'm wondering if perhaps the basis of that book is kind of a similar thing, where you were using the guide of the Book of Coming Forth by Day, as well as other things, to then give a modern person, someone who lives today, let us say, I know the word modern, we can debate all we want, but someone living today, your book is kind of an access point for some of the what might seem more foreign concepts or things that they might come across in the Book of Coming Forth by Day.
Right. Thank you. I think that I'm hoping that what my book does is that it provides an entryway for people who are wanting to understand more than just the words that are inside those books. If they're really wanting to understand why those words, why that meaning, what is it about? And again, I think I almost called that book Open Sesame, but it didn't quite work out. But I was thinking it was like how to take a mystery, which is really the greatest mystery we can think of. It's how do you understand your life as you're living it right now? And what's the point of it? And that once you start going through that and you're doing the open sesame of your own life, you are, accessing larger portions of your consciousness. You're using underworld, you're using subconscious, unconscious, you're using upper world, super consciousness, as well as expanding the outer limits of what you say you're aware of at this time. There's this whole bandwidth of consciousness that on the everyday, most people don't pay attention to it, but it's all accessible. It's there for you to use. I had this really exciting and interesting experience today sitting outside. I've come to Kentucky to the old farmhouse where we used to live, and I'm sitting here in the yard with my husband, and I hear, he goes away into the barn, and I hear this voice. While I'm sitting there, and I heard this man say, you come over here and you get in that house right now. But he had this kind of very strange, like a metallic sound to his voice. And I thought, I literally thought there was someone walking around outside. So I went to see, and sure enough, there's no one there. So I mentioned this to my husband when he came back, and he said, oh, the guy who used to live here before I bought this house had his larynx removed due to cancer. That must have been him.
Wow.
Okay, then. So it's like that's an everyday awareness of something that we don't normally think that we have access to. But once we sort of open ourselves to the possibilities that all of these things can and might happen, the likelihood of their happening is more so. Which is one of the things that I was hoping I could get, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, when I did Awakening of Osiris, I translated it trying to not just use words, but to use the tactile sensory language, the feelingness of the world, and then I wanted to work with sounds in the way that poetry and chant works with sounds. Then I wanted to put the mythology and the narrative back into the language. And in this case, I'm working with other texts like the Pyramid of Unas, like the Litany of Ra, like the Book of Two Ways. And I'm doing that with my small version, my small translations of some of those texts, but I'm exploding it into, and this is what it means, and this is why I think it's important for us to look at this particular thing. And again, it's all about what some people would think of as magic or spookiness or, the thin veil. But really, it's accessible at any moment if we only opened our eyes and our ears and our hearts to it.
And especially this time of year, we're going into what's often called the dark time of year, and people will say that at the end of this month, the veil is the thinnest between us and the spirit realms. And in imagining the world into existence, I was just looking at the chapters, and the latter chapters seem to focus a bit on that particular journey or the work in that kind of darker, more underworld realm. Because you have the journey to Duat, followed by traveling through the dark, then articulating the portals of life and death, the temples of gold, stone, and flesh, and then Osiris is the seed. So just narrowing down just a little bit in imagining the world into existence, could you maybe just speak to that series of chapters and how they might serve as a guidebook or a workbook or a manual for people to use, especially during this darker, more introspective time of the year?
Okay, well, I do think that the journey into the Duat is really, as I mentioned before, is helping us to understand the ways in which our lives are transformed on a daily basis. You know, the coming of the light, the coming of the dark, and so on. I'm trying to figure, like, as we get more toward the end of that book, what I'm seeing is that you can think of yourself as being a seed that's being buried in the ground, you know, and that what you have to do during this period of time, you know, when the veils are thin and when it's the darkest time of the year, is to learn to put your roots down into that darkness. So that, you know, you're not going to access the incredible potential of the upper world until you have really strong roots into the dark time. And so, you know, this is a good time of year to be planting yourself into that understanding of dreams. I mean, that's a big thing that I talk about in that book. Spending much more time in meditation. I find that the work that I'm doing in understanding these altered states of consciousness comes to me more when I am sitting in a darkened room in meditation, and I mean completely, totally lightless. There's not a digital clock. There's not a crack of light through the window. It's all covered, you know, as dark as it could possibly be. And I have to say, I live in a house now that is on the grounds of a spiritualist camp. And the front room of my house was the original seance room for that camp, built in 1904. And it has completely shuttered windows that, you know, close from the outside so that no light comes into it. And it's really funny. Sometimes I'll go lock the door at night, you know, and I'm just going to bed. And all of a sudden, all the shutters will shut, and the door will shut, and it'll be completely dark. And I have to go, sorry, guys, not tonight. I'm just going to sleep. But I have been working to try to work in the dark through meditation to access realms that my light eyes, my all-day seeing eyes, would try to fool me with what's reality and what's not reality. And in this case, I can go into a complete trance state where my consciousness, you know, floats away and I'm just there. And then I can feel, you know, the energy coming in from other spaces. And I think that that's, you know, you can feel the changes in your body. You know, you can feel... you can actually begin to see light moving in the room, in a completely darkened room. You can begin to see that there's a process of energy that is like a battery that you're looking at. I think that in these dark times, it's especially good for us to work with these kinds of altered states. Now, I recommend, you know, prayers for protection before anyone does this, and I also recommend working with someone, sitting with someone. You know, we have been sitting with trumpets trying to create some auditory work inside there, and we've had a few taps on the trumpet that we've heard, but we've not, you know, gotten any further than that. But hey, you know, I'll figure I'm new at this, and it takes a long time to develop that kind of talent. So.
And it strikes me when you talk about, like, really setting those roots into the darkness before you can access the higher realms or the light realms. It's almost as if you have to do the work to be prepared to come into the light. Otherwise, you'll come into it and be blinded or burned. And it's that important foundation work to keep that from happening.
I think that's exactly right, you know, and you have to do it very consciously and very, very slowly and very with an attitude of reverence as you do that, you know. It's funny that you mentioned that, you know, because the light blinding you, because I actually had one of those experiences where I was sitting in this darkened room, and it was completely dark, even though it was daylight outside, and had someone come to the door and knock, and it was as if someone had hit me in the stomach. You know, I was, like, not ready for that. My solar plexus was, you know, vibrating for, you know, I was, like, sick to my stomach for the rest of the day. It's like, okay, now I have to learn to put the sign on the door, you know, shh,
yeah.
Go away. Like, okay, lesson learned. You know?
Right. And I think that go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, one of the things that's interesting to me is that as I've been in that darkened room and I'm learning how the energy affects me, it reminds me of the way the energy hits my third eye and hits my crown chakra and hits my solar plexus, reminds me of the images of the cobra, fire-spitting cobra that's on the, I think it's the second coffin of gold in Tutankhamun's chamber. So if you actually, like, go online and look it up, you can see the serpent spitting fire into the ajna in the crown chakra and the solar plexus. And it's amazing to, you know, it's like, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. That's that turning of consciousness, you know.
Is that Wajet or is that a different serpent?
I think it's a picture of the Kundalini serpent. You know, it's the, of course, every serpent is an image of the goddess. Most serpents are images of the goddess. But this one in particular, you know, I don't even know if it's got its name on it, but I think it could be Mereseker, which is the Lady of the Peak, which is what they called her. She's in all of the Valley of the Kings tombs, this winged fire-spitting cobra serpent, and she's called the Lady of Silence or Mystery.
And I think that if people are going to embark on doing some of that internal work, the meditation, the dark work that you were talking about, something that could be very useful to them in doing that work, both preparing for it as well as what they are experiencing while going through it, is to use your companion book to Imagining the World into Existence, which is called Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, because that's going to really help give them prompts and give them exercises for journaling that can help to focus that work, both going into it as well as what they experience when they come out of it and how to write about it.
Right, and it allows you to, you know, to talk about your shadow experiences. You know, there are sections on facing your fears and imagining your alternate selves, you know. So there are different things that you can do that'll, like, pull you in different directions. To see your life as a hero's journey really is the task of the Book of the Dead. And so that book, too, Invoking the Scribes, is about how to see your life as a hero's journey with all its losses and gains and possibilities.
Yeah. And
another thing that I think is really good that I have done during this period of time is that I have created... I live near a creek, and I've created these little, I guess, henu boats is the best way to describe them. They're basically plywood, you know, that I've painted with images of the boats of the underworld, you know. And I will put, at this time of year, I will put images of people that I've lost, photographs of the people that I've lost during the year. I will also do any kind of artwork about things that I am letting go of, old ideas, you know, and I will put it into the creek with candles and let it set sail, you know, and watch it disappear. It's quite an amazing thing.
And I've both seen and done something like that as well, and I would encourage people to try to do something like that. You know, of course, use natural materials if you're going to be putting it into water and letting it go. but finding a creek or a river or the ocean or even a lake or something where you can have that physical, visceral sense of it setting sail and going away from you can be very powerful.
I think so.
And can you just give a little bit of insight for your book, Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, just kind of the format of that book and how it's used with its writing prompts and exercises and that kind of thing?
Okay, sure. I created that book because I wanted to give people the experience of writing their own Book of the Dead, because my process of writing Awakening Osiris was 10 years. Of going through every single chapter. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to give people an experience of writing their own Book of the Dead? And so we created a tour to Egypt that was based around this idea, so that every single temple where we went during the day, and most temples are there because a body part of Osiris was said to be buried there, the head, you know, the foot, the you know, the hand, et cetera. And so we would devise a writing prompt based on that particular temple, based on the energies of that particular temple. So like when we went to the temple of Khnum, who's the god who creates people on creates people in their cause on his potter's wheel, we wrote about the idea of creating ourselves and our bodies, you know, naming our sacred bodies and so on. And so, you know, there were different kind of tasks at each particular temple that I would give an assignment and we would come back to the boat and everybody would write and we would share what was going on. So that book contains not only the writing prompts, but the writing that resulted from those writing prompts, as well as some historical information about the particular temple, as well as meditations that we did inside those temples, as well as a day-to-day log from the travelers themselves about what that trip was like every single day. And so it's really a remarkable book of writing and traveling, you know, a true spiritual sojourn. And I was very happy with the way it came out.
And I think it's really important having the writing samples in there that people did using the same prompts and exercises, because someone picking up the book and doing that, it's not so much to see how to do it right or wrong, versus it's just an opportunity to see this is how that prompt or that exercise came out for someone in the example given in the book. So people have a better sense of this is how I can approach it, or I see this in action, so now I understand how to work with it a little better.
Right, and they're very different. The writers are very different from each other.
Yeah. And so when I contacted you to be on the show today, it actually was an interesting little bit of synchronicity, because I had specifically contacted you and asked you about perhaps talking about the Egyptian approach to death and the afterlife and the way that they might view the idea of kind of an initiatory process and the transcendence and that kind of thing as we go into the darker time of the year. And you had just finished a retreat that you do with Nikki Scully in Oregon on the Egyptian mysteries. And lo and behold, the focus of that retreat happened to go into something very similar in terms of connecting with the spirit worlds with the ideas of the Akhet and the Duat, which I'll let you describe and define in a minute. And so, one, I wanted you to have an opportunity maybe to just talk a little bit about those retreats that you do on the Egyptian Mysteries with Nikki Scully and what they are and that kind of thing, but then also specifically that idea about accessing or communicating with the spirit world from the approach of the ancient Egyptians and the way they did it.
Okay. It's always a trip to work with Nikki because usually we have this idea, we put the idea out there that this is what we're going to do, and then it's kind of like it's incubating, you know, and a week or so before we actually have the retreat, we have to download basically what it is that, you know, Isis and Thoth want us to do. And so it takes us about a week of going through conversations with Isis and Thoth to figure out how they want to do the particular seed thought that we've planted this time. And as we've done this, I think we've done this for almost 12 to 13 years, something like that, we've discovered that when we go back through the tape that we have recorded of each session, and we realized that we pretty much had created a book. And this last time we felt that, you know, the book was coming to a conclusion at this point. You know, it's now time for us to sit down and pull the material together and turn it actually into a book of Egyptian mystery initiation. And most of these have all taken place at Nikki's, well, in fact, all of them have, except for those that took place in Egypt. They took place at Nikki's retreat center in Oregon. And I have to say, it's usually mostly in the summer, lovely weather. This time, because Nikki had fallen and broken her hip, God bless her, she had to recover, and we couldn't do it until September, which turned out to be a good time because it was my birthday. And, you know, if I had been able to get to Egypt this year, I would have wanted to have spent it in the Temple of Isis, my 60th birthday. But instead, I spent it with Nikki at the retreat center, and it was just lovely. And I had this dream that kind of set the mysteries on their head. I had this dream that I was taking a box of all of my stuff. You know, there's another word that I use to express it, and it's usually a SH with a T word, but it was a box of all my stuff, okay? And I was carrying this box, and it had my purse and my shoes and my papers and, you know, things I was dealing with. I took it out to my car. I took off all my clothes, and I wrapped myself in a sheet. And then I'm trying to carry this box of stuff across, you know, to wherever it is I'm going next, which I don't even know where it is. And I'm all wrapped up in my sheet. I fall down, and I'm suddenly pushing the box with my head like a caterpillar, going down the road, pushing this box. And then all of a sudden I realize in this dream that I'm a pupa, that I'm just like sort of inside this sheet. I'm just like melting into nothingness, you know. And a man comes and helps me across the street. I ask him what he does for a living. He tells me he's a hod carrier. I sort of like that because hod carriers are the guys that carry the bricks for construction, you know. So it's like this new self that I'm building, and also because it's, you know, one of the sephiroths on the Tree of Life. So I'm, you know, sort of helped across the street, and I have this little sidewalk cafe moment. But anyway, it was like Nikki and I realized that what we had to do for this retreat is that we had to wrap everybody up in sheets for the night. It was like, we're going to do what? No, we're going through this whole transformative process. And we wrapped everybody up in a sheet. We were incubating dreams all through this workshop. And the people, even the people who were sleeping in tents, were wrapped up in sheets. And they couldn't talk until they got, you know, to the temple the next morning. And we went through an opening of the mouth ceremony. We went through a typical ceremony that was undertaken at the Hebsed Festival in Saqqara for the Pharaoh when he is he becomes a teknu, is what that's called. A teknu is it's written with this hieroglyph of a blob of stuff with a human head. So it's basically a mummified person wrapped up, but you can see their face. Their eyes are kind of glazed, and they're in a trance state, and they're taken into the pyramid and left there. And in the process of 3 days, then they somehow manage to unwrap themselves. They read what is on the walls. They undergo the process of going up the ladder, accessing the ancestors and the ancestral memories. And then when they come out of the pyramid, they're alive. They're not dead. They come out alive, and they move down a birth canal. And it's really interesting to me because in Unas, that long corridor that goes into the main part of the pyramid actually has hieroglyphs written on it of birthing process. And I had realized that the text was not meant to be read as you were going in and delivering it, you know, a dead body. It's meant when you wake up, you are fed spiritual food inside the sarcophagus room. You go and you talk to the ancestors, and then you get the information that you need, and then you bring it out. You are rebirthed through walking through this tomb entrance that very much is like walking through the womb. And then you come out and are born into this new being, with this new information and this new understanding. And so we were going through this Egyptian mysteries, doing this exact same process as what happens when the teknu goes into the ground and is planted as a seed inside the tomb. So my feeling is that, you know, not every tomb is intended for a body. Some of those tombs are actually intended for transformative experiences, and I think Unas is one of those because it happens to be the one with the text on it.
Oh, yeah. And you had mentioned a couple of terms when we were talking before the show of both the Akhet and the Duat, and I wonder if you might just define those a little bit.
I will. The Akhet is called the light land. And it's that land where the imperishable stars are. It's that land of eternal light. It's also an astral world. So that doesn't mean that you only cross over it after you die. You can access Akhet, you know, from this side, you know. But it's a place of light. And it's a place where you can move around in the astral. And in that way, you have access to, you know, people who are coming from the other side that you can work with. And that's sort of a northern, south-northern access. The Duat is what we think of as the starry realm, or the inside of the belly of the sky goddess, Nut. And she is the epitome of the womb and the tomb combined, because she births the child. She's the night sky bending over the earth, and it's really beautiful. She actually resembles the Milky Way stretched from end to end across the horizon. And she births the sun in the east, and then it rolls across her body during the daylight to the west, and then at night she swallows it. And the sun or the light moves through the darkness through the inside of her body, which is called the Duat, or the starry realm, okay, and then is reborn the next day. And the Duat has a number of mansions. You know, we've heard that sort of Christian, in my father's house are many mansions. Well, in my mother, there's many mansions, too. You know, inside the belly of the goddess, there are all these places that we move through, that we go. There's the darkest dark of the night, which are the fourth, fifth, and sixth hours. oh, well, you're really inside the belly, and then, you know, that's where the deep transformation comes. And you see these beautiful images. The Duat was carved on almost every wall of those tombs in the Valley of the Kings, and you would have to move through these particular rooms until you got to the bottom of the tomb where the sarcophagus was. But this story of, you know, moving from light into dark is written on one side of the wall. Then you get to the darkest part of the night, which is where the sarcophagus is, and then it comes out, and you see the next mansions or rooms are on the opposite wall where you're moving back into the light, so that it actually, like, sort of mirrors as you walk in. Like, you read it on the left. As you walk out, you read it on the right. That makes sense?
Yes, it does.
And it's, yeah, it's written with a star, you know. So anytime you have a circle with a star in it, that's the Duat, that's the underworld. But when you just have a star, it's, you know, the night sky, the portal, any kind of portal or gateway.
So we often hear at this time of year that the veil is the thinnest, and this is often a time when people think about contacting their ancestors or doing something for the spirits in the other world. What suggestion might you have if someone wanted to do that during this time of year from an Egyptian approach or technique? What might be a suggestion you would have for somebody to try doing that during this time of the year?
Okay, one thing that I think would be really a good thing to do is to work on writing a letter to someone that you want, that you in particular want to contact. And you can have a diviner's bowl, and usually it's a clay pot with it can have like a green glaze on it. Or it can just be like sort of an okra kind of clay pot. You know, it can be natural. And then what you do is you take a vegetable dye. So you have like mint or lettuce or any type of green matter that you can like crush and pound and sort of turn it into ink, basically. And you write the name of the person that you wish to contact on the inside of the bowl, you know, and you cast your invocation in whichever language you would like to do it. You ask your dream guide to assist you, and the ancient Egyptians would use a number of dream guides. Sekhmet was a favorite, the lion goddess Sekhmet and her sister Bast, were the cat goddess, were often invoked in the process of asking for a dream and contact with this particular individual. Another dream god highly favored was Bes, the god Bes, who is an African sort of pygmy god. Anyway, you write all this in vegetable ink on the inside of the bowl. And then as the sun is going down, you pour pure water into the bowl. You slosh it around until the vegetable ink is mixed with the water. And then I like to say, looking at the moon, you drink this particular concoction, and then you place the bowl beside your bed and you go to sleep. Say nothing to anyone. You simply lie down in the dark and go to sleep. Now, in some of the particular spells, they have like an eye guard over your face so that, you know, again, you're imitating no light coming in, okay? So, and that's usually, you know, if you insist that you're going to have this dream and you go through all the preparations of having this dream, the veils are already thin, and you've set your intention, and we know that intention is like half the task, you know. And pretty much most people I have found will have a dream. The other thing that I have found, which is interesting, is that this is a really good time to do dream incubations in group who are dreaming of the next step for their community, for example. So it would be a good time for people to dream together, do the same ritual, do an invocation, like two sekhmet, and then to sleep all at once and wait until the morning, you know, no breakfast, and everyone sits down and tells the dream together. Interestingly enough, many of the dreams will resonate with each other if you are dream incubating in a group, and they're pretty powerful that way.
And I think also you often find that the dreams have been very similar.
Yes, you do. You do find that.
And a couple of things I might also suggest for the technique that you just offered is, one, for people to make sure they keep either a journal or a recording device next to their bed as well, so that as soon as they wake up, they're able to record whatever dream or dreams they had before even really moving to get out of bed. Two, I was also thinking that if someone has an altar space or an ancestor altar or a temple space or a meditation space that they use regularly, because that has kind of built up that energy, that would also be a really good place to sleep for that night. You know, because it's kind of like doing the dream incubation where people would go to the temples for that kind of thing. We may not have a temple to go to, but we've kind of created a temple energy and space, especially if we have an altar or meditation space that we use all of the time that's built up that kind of energy. So I think that could also be very conducive for helping that dream process.
Yes, exactly. That's perfect.
Now, and I know you have limited time, and I just wanted to ask and see if you have time to do some readings with a couple of people, or if you need to go. And
sure, I do. Yeah, I can do a couple.
Okay. So there's a couple of people that are here, and we will go ahead and go to the first person. And this is Anne calling from New York. Are you there, Anne? Hello, Anne.
I'm here. Hi.
Oh, hello. First of all, Normandy, do you want to just tell us what kind of readings you're going to do? Are you using cards? Are you doing trance?
No, I'm going to use cards, and I'm using Murray Hope cartouche deck, which has Egyptian energy and imprints on it, and I'll be using a star pattern. So
okay.
It works best if you just kind of tell me in general what you want to know about, and then we'll see where the energy goes from there.
Will do. One of my main concerns is the financial aspect of my life in regards to will it improve or is it improving? That's what I'd like to
know
in general.
All right.
And my spirituality.
That sounds good. Okay. Thank you. Okay, well, I see that it's in a process of transformation right now. And you have the God thought over top of your, you know, sort of over the question right here, which tells me that I'm being impressed to say that this is about you're finding the right combination of energies that you need in order to create the wealth that you're trying to bring to fruition. It seems like there's been like a lack recently that you are trying to heal the lack. And I would say it's going to come through a combination of energies. You will also find that your best lucky charm, as it were, is going to be working with women. Other women will be your lucky charm. It's not as if you have to consciously go out and find them. In fact, it's going to be something, someone that you dream about or something that comes to you in dreams or seems to come from the unconscious is going to be the answer to what you're looking for. I do see things improving. I do see a healing. I see that I see you being given a vision of what you want to create and being able to bring it into really into manifestation fairly easily if what you are able to do is to envision it first. So I'm going to ask you to try a journal exercise which will have you writing down what you want. You know, this is what I want, okay? This is what it looks like, you know, and so to, and then when you write what it looks like, you're doing an affirmation. You're doing a visualization that sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. This is what I want. This is what it looks like. And then I want you to do like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are 5 steps to get there. Okay? Now, as I said, it's going to come from a couple of different things that you're going to do together at the same time. So I would ask you to do that process 3 times and then to take those 3 things and put them on your altar. You know, write your visualization, your scenario of what it's supposed to look like. Put them on your altar. Put a white candle on top of it and leave that there, you know, for a moon cycle and see where it goes from there. Okay?
Okay. Okay. Can I ask you a quick little question regarding my love life?
well, we have, because there's other people in the queue, we have to just do one question.
Okay.
But, well, I'll offer you 2 things. If you want to stay on the line towards the end of the show, if there's still a little time, I'll be here still and can do readings that way. But also, I have a Tuesday show, the second Tuesday of each month called The Amethyst Historical. We offer readings on that, as well as the 4th Sunday of each month here on Firefly Willows Live. We have an all call-in show. So if we're not able to get back to you today.
One is good enough for me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for the reading. Very insightful.
Thank you, Anne.
Information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a blessed day.
You too. And let's see if we can pop over to one more. So this is someone calling from area code 530.
Okay.
Are you there?
Hello?
Hello? Are you calling from area code 530?
Sure.
And what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Donna, and I live in Westwood, California.
All right. And what is it that you'd like to ask a question about for a reading?
Upcoming changes in our home location or just living situation.
Okay, so you're asking about a home relocation or moving, is that right?
Right, or just changes within our household or the structure thereof, or even physically moving or whatever like that direction.
So basically, whether to make a physical move or whether to just change the environment that you're already living in.
Okay. Whether it be physical move in that area.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I see that there are. It seems to me that there are some problems with where you're living right now. I have a set card that's showing me there's some obstacles or maybe some blocked energy. So you have both Osiris and Set in this particular layout. But you also have the god Anubis, who's really good at finding answers to these difficulties and these problems. And the ultimate outcome is the Earth card, which is a card of stability. I'm going to draw one more thing and see whether I have a travel card or a paper card. Oh, okay. I got the card of air. So I'm feeling that there is a change that needs to happen in order to remove the blocked energy. One of the first things that I would do is to make sure that you do a cleansing ritual on the house where you are, because I'm seeing that some of the energy might be blocked, just attached to the house itself. Okay.
Okay.
So that can help move that energy around, and see if that clears up the situation. And in the process, I would make sure that your plans and communication with any partner who's in this building with you, that the two of you like sit down and agree on what you need in your situation and where you need to go. Kind of make sure that you have that plan. But first, the cleansing, I think, would be the best thing to start with.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in.
You bet.
Have a good day.
You too, guys.
Thank you.
And, well, there's one more person waiting, Normandy. You tell me if you have time for that, or I can do that a little later in the show.
I have time for one more. I do.
One more. All right. So this is someone calling from area code 720. Are you there, caller? Hello. What's your name and where are you calling from?
I'm Michelle, and I'm calling from Colorado.
Colorado. All right. And what is it you'd like to ask about for a reading?
I would like to know if you can see when am I going to get an investor for my business.
All right.
An investor for your business. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I definitely see that four of the five cards which I drew for you are feminine.
Okay.
You have the Buckle of Isis. You have the card of Isis herself. You have the card of the goddess Bast, who deals with things of a feminine nature. You have the Lotus card, which I'm being impressed to say has to do with peace, healing, has to do with things that of a spiritual and soul nature. And then you also have this fire card, which is a lot of energy, seems to be building around finding your partner in a community of women. Okay?
Okay.
And the Buckle of Isis is a very fertile is a very fertile sign. The Bast image has the sistrum as part of it, and it's being shaken. And so what I'm being impressed to say is that if you get into a group of entrepreneurial women, a women's group that, you know, women business owners and so on, and just, like, start talking to people about what you want to do, your energy and your own verve and passion for what you want to create is going to attract attention. And you do not really have to push much further than that, because the Lotus is telling me that it's coming around the back door. It's very gently coming toward you. But your passion for what you do will become apparent to these other people, who will then feel more aligned to help you with your business endeavor. Looks very good, very promising.
Thank you. Yes, I know this is definitely a spiritual business, and so that's another part of it, too, that I know this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Yeah, I said this is a spiritual business that I'm taking on. And so I know that it's a part of, you know, my spiritual journey. So I know that it's what I'm supposed to be doing.
That's right. It does look, it looks very good. Yes.
And I had pulled some cards as well, and I would just reiterate that, because the first card that came up was the High Priestess, which I think really reconfirms that both the spiritual aspect of this is extremely important for what it is you're doing, as well as exactly what you need to be doing. Also, the High Priestess, like Normandy had, is a very feminine card. So again, I think who will be interested in investing is going to probably be either a woman, or you could say someone who is very feminine in the way that they act or approach their life, or they have that very receptive quality, that kind of thing. High Priestess is also a spiritual leader, so it may also be somebody that already has some sort of leadership or success or position as a spiritual leader. And the Ten of Cups came up right next to that, which is really the ultimate card of happiness. But it also very traditionally was a marriage card. So again, there's a sense that somebody is coming probably fairly soon. And I would say, because it's cups or water, that one, I would pay attention to the next water sign period, which is Scorpio. Scorpio will be like October 20th to November 20th. So really pay attention to who you come into contact during that time. That seems to be a very fertile time for meeting the right person or people that will be interested in investing in and being a part of your venture.
Okay. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome.
Have a wonderful and supreme Sunday.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Normandy, thank you very much for joining me on the show today and for offering to do readings. I think it's not something that I've actually heard you do very often, at least in appearances on shows and things. So thank you for being willing to do that.
Well, thank you for asking me. It was kind of fun.
And I know you're off to smell and kiss a newborn baby, newborn grandchild, I believe. So
I have a little grandchild named Everett, and he's here, and I'm going to go sniff his little head.
Excellent. Well, we will not keep you from that any longer, but thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. And again, I'll just remind people, if they would like to find out more about you, the books and things you have, as well as the trip to Egypt and the workshops that you do, they can visit your website at www.normandyellis.com, which is normandiellis.com. So,
thanks again.
Thank you.
Hi, C. Great talking with you.
Thank you, and enjoy your grandchild.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And coming up in just a moment, we'll have our Living Well segment with Linda Wiley. And if there is anyone still on the line or still listening that would like to get a reading following the Living Well segment, if there's anyone still there, I will be able to take those calls and do a reading for them as well. So if you are interested in that, then feel free to Skype in or call 646-716-5510, and I will do a reading for you just after the Living Well segment. All right, we'll be right back.
At Firefly Willows LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us. Host a show or be a guest or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable change makers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. Your monthly guide to the well-being of your body, mind, and spirit. It's about an alternative approach to life, healing, and living well in our changing world. Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. A return to this understanding of the truth of food and the value of food within our lives. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Let life go on in it, unhindered, and let it defend itself. It will do more than if you paralyze it by encumbering it with remedies. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace. To realize our connection with all of life, and the plant and animal kingdom, and how we support and help each other in our process. I am Linda Wiley, and this is Living Well with Linda. October, blessed October. Its arrival of fall and all those yummy warm fall colors, the golds, orange, yellows, bronze, reds. They beckon from beyond to take us into the inner sanctum of our own being, which will be our home for the next few months. Life starts to change now, from the outside to the inside. Let the fall colors fill your whole being with the deep warmth and joy at going within. It's time to celebrate the coming season of looking within, thereby not dreading the dark of the approaching winter. Of eating warming, soothing foods, of sitting by the fire, ruminating on life that has been, and what we can perhaps let go of or see more clearly, how to move ahead in a more heartfelt, healthful way. It is perhaps a time of seeing how we could do life differently, looking at and studying a new way of living on and off and with the land, our true home. Perhaps permaculture might be a subject I could suggest, for it is the best ride forward I can find in this monkey circus we have come to call life. More on this later, but for now, we honor October. This is a little poem, part of a song by Lorena McKinnon called All Souls Night. Bonfires dot the rolling hillside. Figures dance around and around. Strums that pulse out echoes in the darkness. dancing a waltz on All Souls Night. The ancient Druids who inhabited what we now call Great Britain placed great importance on the passing of one season to the next, holding fire festivals which were celebrated for 3 days, 2 days on either side of the day itself. Many consider the most important of these festivals to be Samhain. The name probably comes from a Gaelic word which literally means summer's end. Samhain marked the end of summer and the beginning of the new year for the Celts, with the day after Samhain being the official date of the Celtic New Year. The Celts chose this point in time as their new year because it is a time when the sun is lowest on the horizon, as is measured by the ancient standing stones of Britain and Ireland. Samhain occurs in the mystical between time after the last day of summer and before the first day of winter, when the veil between the worlds is at its thinnest, when those souls who have passed could, if they wished, return to the land of the living, when the usual laws of time and space are suspended. Samhain bonfires once were lit upon every hilltop in Britain and Ireland as soon as the sun went down on October 30th. To the ancient Celts, fire was the physical symbol of holiness, divinity, truth, and beauty, and the Samhain fires served a number of purposes: to honor the gods and goddesses, to light the dark night and usher in the light of the new year, to purify the ritual space or home, and to ward off evil. The fire was also used to guide the souls of the dead home to their kin. On this night, all the hearth fires were extinguished and relit from a common source, the druidic fire that was kept burning at the center of Ireland. The only other time it was permitted to be extinguished was with the fire at Beltane, which marked the second half of the Celtic year. The old ashes were strewn in the garden to bless them and ensure a fruitful harvest the following year. In many parts of the British Isles, the fires are still lit on Samhain to honor the old ways. I say we should do the same thing. It is a time when fruits, ripe fruits and nuts were gathered, preparing some for the feast and others to be stored for the long winter ahead. For those who rely on farming to exist, this marks a time when the herds are thinned, so there will be enough food for the livestock through the winter months. In Belgium, it was an old custom to prepare cakes for the dead, small white cakes and cookies, and they were strewn here and there to honor the spirits, and it was said that the more of these you ate, the more the dead would bless you. Elsewhere, food offerings were left on altars and doorsteps for the wandering dead. In the pagan tradition, Samhain is the night when the old god died and is mourned by the crone goddess for the next 6 weeks until he was reborn at Yule. The popular image of her as the old Halloween hag menacingly stirring her cauldron comes from the Celtic belief that all dead souls return to her cauldron of life, death, and rebirth to await reincarnation. With the rise of Christianity, Samhain was changed to Halloween, and it has become what it is today. Not necessarily all that it was, but it carries a modern twist. However you choose to celebrate this time, whether you choose it to celebrate at all, may the season be filled with many blessings. In our tips section, the first thing I'm going to start with today is making frog. Now, I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but it is a traditional drink that is prepared at this time. The Celts had a lovely divinatory practice associated with this season, preparing this drink and using the game. It was a way of toasting the harvest. It's a very simple to make. It's a full taste, rich of the harvest. In old times, it was drunk in the north of Scotland. It was a stout beverage blended with oats, thinned with scotch and water, and flavored with honey and spices. There are many ways to make this ancient recipe, but the very simple one, and it serves up to 6. Half a cup of fine oatmeal, 1 1/4 cups of fresh heavy cream, 3 tablespoons of honey, 3 tablespoons of Scotch whiskey, And the charms, which are optional, would be a small coin, a ring, a smooth pebble, and a button. So first you toast the oatmeal in a skillet until golden brown. Whip the cream until stiff. Stir the honey, scotch, and charms into the cream. Do not stir in the oatmeal. And then place layers of cream and toasted oatmeal in a large glass bowl and set in the refrigerator to cool for an hour. Then traditionally you give everybody a spoon. You know, you let everybody dip out of it themselves. And whoever finds the coin shall come into wealth. Whoever finds the ring shall find true love. Whoever finds the pebble shall gain his hopes. Whoever finds the button, alas, shall fall into poverty. Maybe I wouldn't put the button in. You know, we don't want any bad wishes. So, farag is a creamy, smooth custard and a belt of scotch all at once. In other words, it's wonderful. So have fun with this and enjoy it at your autumn feast. Another tip, get your winter space in order. Get some candles, some books, some warming teas. Get your wood stacked and your food gathered. Indeed, a strong winter seems to be upon us. At least here in Oregon, it feels that way to me. Gather things of comfort for you and have them ready. Start to let go of the outer activities and see that this is indeed a time to start to go within. If we could all know that the earth goes within at winter and that this is what happens as the earth takes rest, and that we are no different from the earth, then we could accept more easily this time rather than be consumed with movement and keeping us from rest and looking within. It's a sweet time to take stock of all that has been and will be. It may not be easy as we see within ourselves, but this is imperative for life to continue. We must reacquaint ourselves with the darkness and know that it is healing and life-supporting. Take an art class. Creativity is one of the juiciest ways of seeing ourselves and loving what is. It is a gift of this life, along with so many other things life offers. Thanksgiving is coming. Books. The Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture, Creating an Edible Ecosystem by Christopher Shein. That's S-H-E-I-N. Wild Fermentation, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Cultured Foods by Sandor Katz, K-A-T-Z. Real Fermentation, Preserving Whole Fresh Foods with Live Cultures in Your Home Kitchen by Alex Lewin, L-E-W-I-N. Fermentation is such a helpful way to get all the bacteria we need within our gut, which many call the brain of the body. Introduction to Permaculture by Bill Mollison, one of the fathers of permaculture. Creating a Life Together, Practical Tools to Grow Eco-Village and Intentional Communities, Diana Christian. And then for our looking within and seeing other things more deeply, perhaps, The Freedom of Being, At Ease with What Is, by Jan Fraser. Next time we will delve more deeply into permaculture, for it is indeed about living well. Until then, enjoy. Thank you for joining me today for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley. If you would like to chat further with questions, comments, or consultations, please contact me at linda@prestia.com. Thank you and blessings to all. Blessings to all. Have a great rest of the day. We'll be right back.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi-C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi-C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
And we're back, and it looks like there were just a couple more people who are waiting to get a reading today. So let's see if we can do that for you. First person is calling from area code 530. Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am.
What's your name and where are you calling from?
Donna from Westwood, California.
Oh. Well, we talked to you a little while ago, didn't we? So
yes,
I guess you already got your reading. Okay.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
I did have another question if you wanted to address it.
Sure. What's the question?
Recently, one of my daughter's husband died, and I just want to know if you had any thoughts on how to help her deal with this and her kids to deal with this. It was, you know, really exciting with her, right?
So just basically how she's going to be able to navigate through this?
Right.
All right. So one thing that I will tell you is whenever I do readings for someone, if they're asking about somebody else, we always do it in relationship to you. So we're going to look and see what it is that you need to know and what you can or need to do to perhaps help her in this situation or during this time.
Right, and that's actually probably more accurately put than what she needs to do. Thank you.
So the card that came up for you is Father Wind, which more traditionally might be called the King of Swords.
Right.
This would show us that you have to be the one who keeps a good head on your shoulders, that maintains perspective and objectivity. That here it's the suit of wind, so there's also a sense that you may have to be the one who is the wind in her sails for a little while when she's feeling very deflated based on what's happened and what she's dealing with, because her card is the Tower card. So right now she's feeling as if her whole world is crumbling down. And
yeah, sure.
So, you know, one of the traditional images of the Tower is a tower blowing up and people are like being thrown out the window, so they're kind of flying through the air, having been thrown out. And here, if I think about you being the wind, then it's a sense of when she's feeling as if she's just in free fall, you need to be the one who comes and helps to offer a perspective on things, who is able to be that wind that helps her to start to float in the air and fly rather than to feel as if she's falling to the ground. So just know that, and it's a king or a father card, so there's a sense of being there when needed, offering what is needed, but the king or the father tends to be more about discipline and structure. So it's helping to manage and maintain the structure and the organization of things while she's trying to figure out how to start picking up the pieces. So if you can help with organizing, you know, household things to make sure the kids are getting to school, or organizing the finances, or taking care of arrangements. You know, I know, like when my partner's aunt died, I took care of the a lot of the financial things so that he and his mother didn't have to worry about that while they just focused on what to do for the funeral. So focusing on some of those kind of things is going to be extremely important in what you can do in a very helpful way. Also, the Chariot card is here, so I think that perhaps offering to either send them or take them on a trip of some sort just to get away from things. And it doesn't have to be a long trip. It could just be a weekend away someplace or something like that. But I think that being able to do that where it's like you would be the driver so that she doesn't even have to worry about the stress, quote unquote, of driving. She just gets to get in a car and go wherever it takes her and, you know, arrangements that have already been made as to where to stay, so she doesn't have to think about anything. It's just she shows up and gets taken to wherever.
Oh, yeah.
And so that is also something that I think in the near future would be very helpful, perhaps for the holidays or something, maybe taking a trip which allows for the opportunity to get away from the place and the things that are going to remind her of who has died. Especially during the holidays, it can be very difficult. So you might think about, instead of doing maybe a traditional, you know, everybody gathers at home kind of thing for the holiday, that you take a trip or go out and do something instead, so that there is a little bit of a separation or distance for her.
Okay.
So that's, I think, what is needed in the very immediate and near future that you could do to really help and support her at this time.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Heisey.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You bet. You have a good day today.
You too.
Thanks.
And let's see. Let's see if, did Anne from New York stay on the line? Are you still there, Anne? No, I guess she felt she got her question answered earlier. So that will wrap up our show for today. I will remind you that you can always find me, communicate with me, contact me, HiC, on Facebook at Revolution with HiC. Just do a quick search, or it's facebook.com/Revolution with HiC. I'm here with Revolution the second Sunday of every month. I'm also hosting or co-hosting the Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, on the second Tuesdays of each month, and I co-host that with Charlie Harrington. And if you're interested in getting a reading with me, then you're welcome to contact me via the Facebook page, or you can email me, HiC@tarotbyHiC.net, or HiC@fireflywillows.com. Either one will be fine. And I would be happy to talk to you about doing a private session. So I hope that you've enjoyed the show. I want to say once again, thank you very much to my revolutionary guest, Normandy Ellis. I encourage you to check out some of her works, her newest books being Imagining the World into Existence and the companion book to that, Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt. And I hope that you have enjoyed the show and that you will be tuning in next month, and I will look forward to being with you then. Until then, have an amazing month.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for A Shamanic Life with John Caracella, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.